This is Tammy Simon of Sounds True. We are delighted to partner with Raphael Kushner on the series Teaching What We Need to Learn. We at Sounds True recognize the value of leading with vulnerability and heartful authenticity on the spiritual journey, and we hope you find this series a significant contribution to that goal.
Welcome to another episode of Teaching What We Need to Learn. I'm your host, Raphael Kushner. In this series, I invite renowned teachers from many different perspectives and traditions to take a deep personal dive, to share with listeners in a way that brings us all closer together. I invite you to listen from your heart, opening fully to whatever speaks to you in the here and now. I also invite you to notice when you become curious to learn more, as well as when you're triggered, challenged, or called to share with the listening community. From the page at which you've accessed this recording, you can also click over to the Discuss section. That's where you can engage with one another about the themes of this series in a safe, honoring, mutually supportive way. Where it feels helpful, I'll join the discussion too. My guest in this installment of the series is the extraordinary Terry Patton, a leader in the realm of integral spiritual practice. Terry happens to be a close friend of mine, and I'm sure you'll notice that this informs the interview in what I hope is a helpful way. Terry wanted to make sure that this series delivered on its promise, so he went way out on a limb in revealing the fullness, light and shadows all, of his being. I'm so grateful for that, and I'm confident you will be too. Please check out the great treasures Terry has to offer at integralspiritualpractice.com. Now, I'm delighted to share Terry with you. Terry, it's great to be with you.
Great to be with you, Raph.
We talk all the time about the theme of this series, transparency along with vulnerability and authenticity. And if it's okay with you, Terry, I want to tell a little story to get us started today.
Sure.
Well, most of the time people aren't thinking about what was happening to either the host of this program or the guest in the moments before we began taping our call. So I wanted to share with the listeners today that for me, the issue of transparency was very alive in my morning, because I decided recently that one of the workshop participants from my last workshop at Brighton Bush Hot Springs would be my new primary care physician. And already that had within it a kind of a wobble, because there I was in my usual role, my leadership role, my convening role, and now I was going to be vulnerable in terms of my overall health and well-being. I was going to be showing up in patient mode. So I've started this relationship, and it's been great. And this morning I had to go in to get some blood work done, and I thought I knew exactly where I was going, and perhaps because I hadn't been caffeinated yet because of the tests I had to take, I got a little bit turned around. And so on top of the unusual nature of the flipped relationship, I was late, and I didn't even know if I was going to get there on time or if the test was even going to be able to go forward. And I was feeling a lot of stress. The kind that happens when you know people are waiting for you and you're letting them down, and I actually forgot to bring my cell phone with me so I couldn't call. And even to top that all off, I went to that ancient device called a payphone, and I tried to call information, and the payphone two times took all my money and disconnected the call. So eventually I got to the office, but by the time I was there, my stress was not only internal, something I could feel, but I could tell it was kind of emanating from me. And I was self-conscious about it because, of course, I teach people to be with what's going on in the moment. And so as I described to the front office person and to my new doctor all about my crazy morning and getting lost and not being able to call them, etc., I could hear a kind of wind up in my voice. I could hear you know, a nervousness and just, you know, a heart rate that hadn't slowed. And I was smiling about it as it was happening because I realized that no matter how evolved we become, no matter how well we learn what we teach, there's still going to be these moments in life where we have our physiological response and we're not going to be able to override it just with the power of presence, acceptance, et cetera. And the only good thing about it was I realized that I was going to talk about it with you, Terry, and share it with the listeners this morning. So that's what leads me to this moment. And one other thing was is that I couldn't caffeinate until I got home, so maybe listeners will hear that I'm talking a little faster with a little more excitement than usual as a result of just having had my coffee right now.
What a great way to start.
Yeah. So I thank you for indulging me in all of that. And then also, you know, in terms of transparency, I want to add that in addition to what I said earlier of you being one of my very closest friends, we've known each other for almost 20 years, and we've been through many life chapters, you know, many ups and downs. And it is actually one of the foundations of our friendship to abide in deep presence and vulnerability with one another. So we're doing live for the public, so to speak, in this call, what we do with and for ourselves whenever we get a chance to get together.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Well, so the theme here, teaching what we need to learn, you know, at first as I contemplated your invitation, first of all, you know, because I love you and because I wanted to support anything you, you know, were doing, you know, I want to say yes to whatever invitation you would give me. I said yes to this without much thought, you know, of course I would do this. But of course I was aware that this theme is, it a little bit turns on the head the usual rhetorical stance that a teacher is supposed to stand in. Like when I am speaking to anyone about what I do understand, the lessons that I learned last year or when I, you know, that are complete, that are fully digested, that are not still open and incomplete, then using my own story as an example is entirely congruent. But when we say teaching what you need to learn, that's present tense. So it's not about teaching what I needed to learn last year or teaching what I needed to learn 10 years ago. We're talking about teaching what we need to learn right now, and that means showing up in the place where I'm incomplete and where, if we were to think of things in a kind of conventional linear way, where I wouldn't be in a position to teach. It's almost like outing yourself as a incomplete or broken or human person with flaws. And many of the people who I've co-taught with or who I've met as colleagues in the world of psychological and spiritual teaching, even people who teach in more conventional ways, feel most comfortable in the position of presenting themselves as complete. And it's almost like the rhetoric, a lot of the ways I've been taught to teach all depend on standing in the place of your sanity and your serenity and your acceptance and your wisdom and your fullness and your trust and your radiance and your awakening and your clarity and offering your teaching from that place, not from the place where you've been thrown off, where you're confused, where you're wounded, where you're broken, where you're hardened, where you're human in all those ways.
Well,
and
I'm sorry, let me just jump in.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's you know, a really important observation, and I just want to speak briefly to the title of the series because I haven't really done that in other calls yet. There is the adage that we all teach what we need to learn, and that's where the title comes from. And it's sort of like that idea of the wounded healer, is there any other kind? And without the wounding, would someone be able to heal? So in terms of how I'm thinking about that, and this is why I appreciate what you were just putting forward, it wouldn't make sense for somebody to be in a, quote, teaching role about what was raw for them exactly. But as they share, when and if appropriate, about what is up or unfinished or unresolved in them, there's something that happens between themselves and their students or listeners that's just really different. And it seems to come back to what you just said so perfectly. They out themselves as human beings. and it seems to me, and this was behind my inspiration for the series, it seems to me that whenever that happens and however that happens, somehow we all benefit.
Yeah. I'm totally with you. But because we talked about this and because I knew we were going to have this conversation today, I have been feeling into this theme really deeply, and it's been catalytic, actually. I'm grateful for the invitation because I've already benefited from it even before doing the interview. I've realized that there's a sense in which the very, very heart of what I teach, the thing that I've devoted myself to maturing in most, the thing that I'm known most for offering by those who've really delved deeply into my work, is exactly the thing that, in some sense, my whole life is about, my learning. And as you know, Raph, not everybody listening to this interview knows my work probably. You know, for a long time, my website, in fact, it's still mirrors to my website, was Integral Heart. And the core of what I've done, you know, the integral movement, I've written a book with Ken Wilber, Integral Life Practice. I teach practice. And the angle on it that I have always emphasized is the heart. It's the intelligence of Ken's brilliant integral synthesis, but manifested in a completely heartful way, in a way that gets into the embodied feeling ground of experience with all those brilliant distinctions elaborating it, and yet which shows up in every moment, understanding that all of life you're doing a practice. You're always practicing something, and you're reinforcing the, you know, they say that neurons that fire together wire together. Whatever it is you're doing, whatever it is you did all day today, that's what you practiced today, and you reinforced those particular circuits. And so making choices and intending is the core of practice. But where do you make those choices from, and how do you participate, and what is it you reinforce? Well, there the heart is central. You know, only to the degree that I'm here is love, only to the degree that I'm able to feel, only to the degree that I'm fully present am I able to make those choices and embody that practice in the way that I want. So a lot of what I teach is I help people get back in touch with feeling and positive feeling, the truly miraculous joy, the attractive power, the good news at the heart of life. And I help people to get beyond the place where the heart is closed. I help people to go to the place in themselves that already knows the goodness of life and already loves and already wants to be present as a gift and from the heart. It's full of appreciation, full of gratitude, full of care. But, you know, the truth of it is, and I've been thinking about this recently because some exchanges I've had with my younger brother, you know, my personal psychological pattern was really formed in the process of being a mean older brother. My brother was born when I was only 3, and just the configuration of things, I went from being the super center of attention, utter narcissistic supplies to the max, you know, adored and praised and loved and at the center of everything. And then when my brother was born, when I was just about three, he was hurt, he was injured, and he needed a lot of care. And essentially, my parents hired a lovely, loving, thank God, but, you know, she was a wonderful black lady. It was kind of like reminds you of the Help, you know, we raise their kids. I had that kind of a wonderful, loving black nurse in my life, Sadie. But I went from being my mother's, you know, apple of her eye and her constant companion to being shunted to the side. And by the time my brother was born, I was, by the time my brother was old enough so that I was interacting with him, I resented him. And I was mean to him. And that was that meanness, you know, because he had had some injuries. He was dropped on his head. He was colicky. He had allergies. He had troubles. You know, I hurt him in ways that I was horrified by when I got to the age of a kind of self-awareness where I began to have a moral sense. And therefore, at the point where I began to really contemplate, well, what is it I want to do with my life? Who is it I want, you know, what do I want to stand for? I knew that there was a part of my heart that could be a real asshole. I was a prick to my younger brother. I was mean to him. And there was a horror over that. And that knowing of my own heart, to know that I have that capacity and, you know, that capacity for cruelty, and that I've, you know, kind of in my own little way, I started the path a little bit like Milarepa. He'd been a sorcerer. He'd brought down hailstorms that killed his enemies. And then he had to do lots and lots of sadhana to make up for it. Well, I really got that I had to do something different than what, you know, it's like kind of what I'm made of has within it a prickiness or a capacity for prickiness, meanness, hard-heartedness, cruelty. And so in some sense, I have been someone who, you know, you might say is cruel, bringing that meanness or whatever, all the capacity for focus and all the rest into the project of creating, you know, as much of a truly loving, truly wise, truly giving human being out of this closedness. The place that could have been cruel and chose to be cruel in whatever way I did at those young ages, has been reshaping itself to become something else. And that's really kind of the core pivot of my life. So wouldn't it be natural that what I'd eventually find myself teaching is love?
Well, so I was listening very intently as you were describing that situation, and I bowed in gratitude at the place where you described that aspect of your nature that, as you say, was the first part of the pivot from that capacity for cruelty towards love. And I'm wondering, though, do you see that as something that was unique to you, or do you see that capacity as just, you know, one of the infinite aspects of human nature that we all share?
Well, I know enough to know that it is the latter, that it is something we all share. But in doing this interview, it was an opportunity for me to make the confession very particularly and uniquely, and to tell something of my own story, not just universalizing it, but making it about me and my own special particular history, because there's much more vulnerability and, in a sense, more courage, more authenticity, more self-disclosure, and more of a real gift to whoever takes this to heart. Because everybody's got a different pattern. Not everybody was mean to their younger brother. Not everybody's particular psychology hinges on this particular theme in quite the way that mine does.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely true, and I think that as we go forward and explore this together, that everything that you say is going to come to bear. But it was worth pausing to bring that piece in around the issue that some of the teachers I've been talking to have brought up, which is what truly is appropriate to share, and how perhaps we don't want to just trade positive projection for negative projection. So from my perspective, my preference would be not that somebody said, oh, I listened to Terry Patton and he revealed this thing about himself and somehow it makes me think or feel differently about Terry. The gift is in the more vulnerable personal expression, as you described, but it can only be received rightly and fully if a person is understanding that you're speaking to your individual version of the human story. And that's why I wanted to make sure that before we went further, we got it out there, even though we'll stay with the personal, that I would love for a listener to reflect and to resonate back, you know, for him and her, for her or for him, you know, how their own story may show that kind of capacity for cruelty front and center, or maybe repressed, or maybe even they just at this point have a don't know mind about it. They're not sure, but they're wondering. So with all of that, and thank you for indulging me, that I want to come back to you and to your...
I really appreciate your doing that, because I think that's important in terms of framing this up in a way that's truly focusing it on what's going to be most useful to folks.
Yeah. And so coming back to what you're sharing, as you said, it was the big pivot. It was a choice point for you to try to be love and to teach love coming from that background. But I'm wondering, now here it is many years later, and of course you'll share what you choose to share about these recent conversations you had with your brother, but how is this theme that you're gifting us with, how is it living in you right now?
Well, I think first of all, it took me a lot of time to get to a place where I really fully admitted this, and it, to some degree, we become conscious of our psychological themes in a series of waves across our life. You know, our self-awareness is certainly not a binary on and off switch. You know, and you grow in it. And I could have described these events and my feelings about my having been mean and all the rest, you know, back when I was probably 20. But over the decades, I've found myself reflecting on this and taking it to heart at deeper and deeper levels and understanding it in deeper and deeper ways. So at this point, I could make a much more powerful, to some degree, I would say maybe I've disidentified, you know, but only through more deeply identifying. And therefore, I've disidentified with the one who needs to defend himself against the identity of being an asshole enough so that I can really, really see how much, in a sense, of an asshole I am. And only someone who sees themselves as a total asshole can totally practice, because you're not invested enough in transcending the asshole because you're denying some of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the humility and deep remorse over having hurt my brother, because, you know, my brother was a scarred guy, and there's certain ways in which, even in his life as a, you know, basically very successful and in some ways even an awakened man, he's still very scarred by his early childhood, and I played a real role in some of that. So the sense of remorse and the sense of humility and the sense of how important it is that this asshole do the practice of being love in an even more thorough way. It's kind of like I'm not sure that, you know, I would recommend this to every single person. This isn't some universal practice, Raph, but at a certain point in the trajectory of your life, you might find yourself able to do something like what I've been doing just recently, in which I have come to kind of feel that there was a egoic, strategic, me against the other, frightened, ashamed, narcissistic kind of core that was operative, that to some degree is the MO that evolved and evolved and evolved and evolved, is still the tool I have to use. So in some sense, I am, in my own way, in my way of getting off it, I'm realizing that I'm just using all that assholiness to dummy up the most, you know, rich and finely resolved imitation of a truly loving being I can possibly create.
And in
framing it that way, instead of saying, I am a loving man, like I have for significant parts even of my teaching career, but instead of saying, no, I'm an asshole who is just trying his utmost to be doing the very best imitation of an absolutely loving man I can possibly do. The extra degree of humility that creates, and the extra degree of seriousness about me having to interrupt my automatic patterns, that really has been a rich and recent clarification. And I haven't had a chance to teach about it before, so I'm using this interview as an opportunity to express it.
So it's interesting, because what it calls to mind, as you shared it just now using that language, was the 12-step program, where a person, no matter how healed he or she becomes, no matter how their life is no longer ruled by their addiction in terms of their day-to-day experience, they always start out by saying, you know, I'm an addict or I'm an alcoholic. And amongst people in the psycho-spiritual community, there's been a lot of questioning about that, because does it create a certain identity box that is perhaps shame-based or stuck in a kind of religious type of humility that isn't necessarily helpful. But I hear you, although you didn't make that connection that I just did, and you may even have your own response to it, but I hear you kind of coming back to something in yourself as you're describing, and letting it be, and that humility taking you to a deeper place. So as I'm hearing it, and as I'm drawing that parallel, I'm also wondering about that. So I wonder if you could speak to it.
I'm not sure I completely get the point. Could you say a little more, Raph, exactly what is it you're asking me to speak about?
Maybe, as is the case for me, maybe I should say a little bit less. And I'll be clear. So I will, absolutely. I'm hearing something in what you're saying at first hearing or first response that I'm guessing that listeners might too, and that's what I want you to speak to, which is the idea that somehow there's a way in which, by saying, you know, I'm coming from this place, that you're defining yourself or confining yourself.
Oh, I see. Yes. Okay. Sure. That simple thing that this is a yeah. I get. I can speak to that. I'm sorry. I thought you were taking it some level deeper and doing a little. I thought you were doing a bank shot off that point.
it was a straight layup.
Okay, it's a straight ahead pass. I'll take a shot at it. Well, no, yeah. There's a self-identity is such a big thing, and so much of what we do has to do with defining ourselves and often denying, kind of we want to prove that we are not that which we in some dark part of ourselves believe we are. I do not want to, you know, I am feeling like I don't want to be an asshole, so I'm trying to prove that I'm a good man. Other people might be trying to prove they're intelligent or competent or lovable or whatever it is. We're all trying to prove stuff. And the identities that we're embracing and affirming and willing to take on can be so powerfully limiting. I mean, this is why the New Thought movement and the power of attraction, the movie, The Secret, these subtle beliefs, the whole Avatar program is based on discreating beliefs, these limiting beliefs that we have about who we are and how we are so profoundly causative and shaping of so much in our way of showing up as human beings. So under the surface of everybody's virtue is usually a submerged and utterly disowned golem who is the opposite of whatever that virtue is. As soon as I embraced goodness, I was in some sense at first, you know, sweeping the asshole under the carpet and trying to deny that I was that one. As soon as you become inspired by almost anything, there's some opposite of that. And very many of us are actually more deeply wounded by our idealism than we have any idea, because we've created a threshold. We've created a we try to be X, we deny Y. Some part of us is Y. We don't want to be Y. We look away from that. We pretend that's not okay. We experience a split in the psyche. We're this psychic splitting creates a situation where we actually don't even dare to feel everything that's here in the field that is here to feel. And so many human beings are walking down the street. Almost everybody is walking down the street. Honestly, just take a look at a parade of folks going by you at any point in time. And my God, these beautiful, interesting, competent, very capable, apparently adult, successful people are actually afraid to fully feel part of what they're actually feeling. That's our human condition. The splitting.
So let me jump in here, because I'm really hearing you, and I think that this piece really stands for a lot of explication, and so it's great that you're doing it. And so what I want to bring in is this, that I know for myself the truth of what you're describing. And here are a couple of examples. You know, I used to think when I was in my teens that I was virtuous to some sort of saintly degree, and when I went through a crisis and ultimately healing of certain aspects of that in my 20s, I went through a period of shoplifting. And shoplifting is something, of course, that, you know, people will, if they're going to experiment with it, it'll be when they're much younger, not when they're, you know, at an age that they could get incarcerated for. And I didn't do much of it, and I didn't do it for very long, but I could see that I could be immoral, I could be a thief, I could be these things that I never thought I could be, and there was shock in that, but there was also liberation in that, because I was no longer in the stricture of the ideal, as you were just talking about it. And even on a more personal and vulnerable level, I remember around that same time, I broke up with a girlfriend, and I pursued her best friend. And I knew a lot of people who were aware of that, who thought I was sleazy for doing that. Like, you never do that. That's just a horrible thing to do. And I was coming from a place of lack. Like, I didn't get all the love that I needed and deserved. And how, why should I ever turn away from an opportunity to get mine? So I saw that I could be really, you know, coming from a very lacking place, that the same kind of place that anybody robs or steals from or hurts another person in order to get what they want or need. And all of that for me, as it eventually processed through and I got to a more peaceful place around it, got me to be able to say, you know, I'm neither this nor that. I'm neither light nor dark. And ultimately, I'm just a guy. And so I'm wondering if I'm just a guy is different for you than I'm an asshole who's learning to love. So did you see the question I'm asking and why it might be important?
I think I do, although maybe it takes a little more discussion.
Well, I'll just make sure so that we're economical. I'm just saying there's a neutral place where it's all in me, and from that place I can drop all the beliefs that might keep me stuck and really be alive to myself moment by moment and my life and my relationships. That's one way to hold it. And I'm wondering if there's something different.
Well, I think there's some gold. I think there's some gold on both sides of this.
Okay, so
the gold on the normalizing side is that we're not so self-involved. We're not so focused on ourselves and characterizing ourselves one way or another. We're recognizing that, there's no original furniture. Everybody's got their stuff. Everybody's a mix. Our particular darkness and brokenness is not deserving of endless reexamination and self-involvement. And there's a kind of freeing up from self-attention in that normalizing, which I think is really healthy and important. But in the really getting your assholeness in a deep way, with a really like not normalizing it, what that has as goal is it's got the seeds for real remorse, which is the seed for real repentance in the best sense of that word. Metanoia, the Greek for every single language. You look at teshuva, the Hebrew, the Islamic word, taba, I think it is. They all mean basically a 180, a radical turnaround, metanoia, a revolution in your knowing, in your very way of knowing. That is what repentance is. Now, we could call it insight. We could call it, it doesn't have to have a lot of tail between the legs, self-abnegation. But what it requires is, oh, my God, I am making a different choice than the choice I would tend to. And I do think that we all need that. And actually, I'd like to offer a couple of vivid images that for me are really illustrative of this. One of them is a scene in the Roman Polanski movie The Pianist about the fellow in the Warsaw ghetto who survived the atrocities of World War II. In one scene in the Warsaw ghetto, an old man approaches an old woman. This food is so scarce, people are starving to death, and this woman has got some warm soup, and she's got it in her hands, and she's trying to eat it. And this man is coming and trying to take it away from her, and he manages, because he's desperately feeling he's starving, and he manages, in trying to grab it from her, to cause her to spill it on the cobblestone street. And she's just, utterly distraught over losing this little bit of food. But he ignores her, and he gets down on his hands and knees, and he laps the soup off the cobblestone. He is so debased that not only is he stealing food from a starving woman, but then he's so debased that he's getting down on licking it off the ground, the dirty street. And then, of course, there's another vivid image, which is the image that we get from Viktor Frankl from the concentration camp itself, in which he describes people going around the crowded bunks of people who've been watching their fellows die. Some people who are in these beds the night before have died during the day and during the day before. Everyone's in kind of terror. And there were people who would go from bunk to bunk with their last crusts of bread, giving them to people and offering words of comfort, even though they couldn't expect to live, even though they were probably terrified. They chose to show up in that way. And what Frankl drew from that is that we have no choice about the outcomes of our behaviors. We have a choice about how we behave. So if we know that we have it within us to be lapping the food we would steal from another off the cobblestone street. If we get that you create the right circumstances, you can be made desperate enough to really not embody what you want to embody, and therefore you have that capacity for something really that you would not want to. Therefore, you get that, oh, my God, I could be something I don't want to be. It matters that I choose something else. And that awareness, it seems to me, is so important, and it can only it can't be overemphasized. It needs to be re-encountered at different moments in our life so that we're more deeply awake to the fact that we're facing these kinds of choices in little tiny ways in so many moments of the day.
Okay, so let me pause then to try to synthesize what's coming through those two images and what you're sharing about them, which is that it can be helpful to get to the I'm just a guy place, as you described, because we're freed up to not work so hard necessarily to prove who we are or to act out the parts of ourselves that we haven't owned. And so there's a value there, but there's a different and maybe sometimes deeper value of recognizing that at our core we're capable of that which we would wish that we weren't, and that we have choices, big ones and often small daily ones, in which with that awareness, as keen as possible, we're more able to make the choice ultimately that we would want, the choice for love. And that if we don't really embrace the, you know, soup lapping part of ourselves and hold that in as full as possible awareness, we're going to miss opportunities, and we're going to miss parts of ourselves that need another look and that need to be brought more fully into light. How's that for a synthesis?
Yeah, that was nice.
Okay, good.
I'll go with that.
Okay, I wanted to make that synthesis or kind of go over it one more time because I could imagine listeners really wanting to understand why both of those things might be helpful, and specifically why it might be helpful as opposed to somehow shaming to recognize and embrace those parts of ourselves. So the more elucidation about that, the better.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me say a little more about this matter of shame. Because
okay. And before you do, let's inform it with one thing, which is that there are a number of people listening who would say, that's where I'm actually more identified. You know, my job is to learn not to be so shame-based, not to see the parts of myself that I think are worthless or not good enough as who I am. So maybe as you speak to it this next time, that can be incorporated as well.
Yeah, very important. And thank you for pointing to that. That's really true. Well, the first of all, there are a lot of different meanings of this word shame, and mostly we think of shame as, you know, something unhealthy that we want to outgrow or purify. And another way of defining shame, though, is the very deep belief that some part of you is unacceptable. That if people knew, you know, what a mean older brother I was, or, you know, they know something about you, they would reject you. The core of it, people conceal what they're ashamed of because they fear exclusion from the group, from love. They feel that if you knew this about me, you wouldn't love me. And therefore, it's so horrible, it has to be suppressed. I think that defined that way and understood that way, shame is a way of talking about the repression barrier itself. That is, you know, sometimes people say fear is the repression barrier, that we repress what we're too afraid to feel. But I think that although there can be a lot of fear loaded in, it's the place where we think that the result of, you know, the thing that we fear would cause us to be rejected. And it's that, and therefore shame, that I think defines the repression barrier most essentially. So I think that, therefore, it's important to look at the research and defined in that way. Some wonderful research has been done by many people. I particularly like Brené Brown. Many of you may have encountered her wonderful YouTube videos on this idea of shame. And the bottom line is that it's universal. Everybody's got it, and the big difference between some people and others are some people recognize that it's a human thing, and that it's actually by being in a way friendly to themselves, and the fact that they sometimes have a shame attack, and having a kind of humor about that, a fundamental self-acceptance where they get that they're still deserving of connection, and that this universal matter of feeling ashamed at times just arises for everybody, that lets you have a kind of a looser relationship. And instead of absolutely desperately having to kind of stuff this thing into the closet that's so shameful, you begin to kind of be able to relate to it, and you realize that a friendly relationship to your broken parts, the one that's not so freaked out, actually turns that thing that you are ashamed of, the very fact of the shame, in fact, not into a reason to be afraid of separation, but a source of connection. Because everybody's afraid. Everybody's ashamed. I mean, really, but everybody's afraid too. But everybody's ashamed in this deep way. And in this human condition in which shame is arising for all of us, me being somewhat friendly to myself and my shame, I'm a link for you to be more friendly to yourself, your shame, your whole humanity. And by doing that, I am likely to be more connected. I'm actually giving to you in that friendliness to my whole self. I'm friendly to your whole self, and I'm creating an environment of connection. And therefore, normalizing and resolving this relationship to it is key. And therefore, this whole thing about seeing just how much of an asshole I am, let's continue to use me as the example, is not about me having a self-concept of being an asshole and being full of shame. It's about me having a sense of humor and an actual freedom from this fundamental self-concept that I've been so busy trying to prove I'm a good man my whole life that I've lacked a certain kind of freedom. I'm a lot more human, I'm a lot more approachable if you know that I, at some deep level, feel like a bad man. And in that, there's a connection to you and the parts of you you would disown. That's where I go.
Yeah, I really hear that, and I don't know why my mind keeps going to aspects of my romantic history, but in relation to what you were just describing, I remember that there was some time when I was with a woman I was dating. Again, this was in my 20s, and she was really insecure and was trying to find the secret thoughts that I was having that if she knew would prove to her that I wasn't really who she wanted me to be, that I didn't feel about her the way that she wanted me to feel about her. And she was kind of pushing and pushing and pushing. And finally I just said, you know what, it's true. Let's just start with the idea that it's true, that the worst possible thing that you could think that I might be thinking, I am. And let's take it from there. And for me, in the moment, there was a catharsis in you know, kind of poetically outing myself. But it feels to me like it's similar to what you were just describing, is that I gave myself the opportunity to meet it with some gentle awareness, some friendliness, as you describe it, and then my need to repress it or her need to find it out was no longer running the show. There was just something that could pass between us that wasn't about all of that.
Yeah. Beautiful.
So So Terry, I want to, because we could talk forever, and we only have a limited amount of time. I want to shift to something that I know is also really important to you, which is the embodiment of this work and the embodiment that you teach, and therefore to talk about bodies and to talk about the frailty of bodies and the challenges of bodies. And in your life and in mine, we both deal with symptoms and illness. And I guess the first thing I want to ask you in a general way, and please take it wherever you want, is how do your own physical symptoms and limitations, if they do, enter into your teaching and your learning?
That's a novel question. I haven't thought about it in quite that way.
Well, let me tell you something that I shared with one of the other guests in the program, and I'll get your take on it. Maybe it'll send you off and running. We all speak about how important it is to be here now, to live in the present moment, and how presence is the ground of everything. And one thing that I came to see, having been someone who has dealt with chronic fatigue, immune dysfunction syndrome, or otherwise known as we don't know what's wrong with you, for, you know, almost 30 years, that what doesn't get spoken about, but which seems to be very important, is that we can only be present to the degree that we have energy for it. Or another way of saying that is that when our energy is diminished, we can still be present, but there's a different quality to our presence. And at least that's what I've found. And I'm wondering if you found that, and if maybe that opens a door for you to talk about this issue of the body and its involvement in our work.
Well, that's a beautiful example. Drawing from my own experience, I suffer from a condition called Meniere's disease, where, as you know, I will periodically get these really horrible attacks. And when I have one of these attacks, depending, you know, there are varying severities, but they can strike without notice, without any warning. And although they do have a gradual onset, at their very worst, I'm like a severely, severely seasick person, utterly wretched, vomiting, the world spinning around me. I'm completely disoriented. And it's damaging my sense of hearing permanently. And, you know, just it's a one-way trip to hell. It's a two-way trip, but it feels like a one-way trip when you're in the worst of it. It's kind of like it is a kind of deep wretchedness. The people in the Meniere's site who've had some of these other really, really painful conditions like Bell's palsy rate it as it's the worst symptom they've experienced except for Bell's palsy. Theoretically, I don't believe that this is true, but people even rate it as being more painful or more dysphoric than the pains of childbirth. Seems extreme, but whatever. Anyway, it's intense. And so being with intense, intense physical suffering has really been a great teacher to me. At first, I would just kind of hang on for dear life by my fingernails and just try to endure these times. But because, you know, I am a lifelong meditator, and because there is this whole deep dimension of meditative experience and even what I teach and certainly what I practice that has to do with locating a place that is deeper and not subject to the changes of conditional experience, because I had a lot of these attacks, I began to learn to be with them and be with myself from the perspective of that more radical consciousness, and discovering that there is a place where I can be with all of this, and not just be with it in the sense of going out of the body into an altered state and kind of escaping the circumstance. Sometimes I've had to be, you know, I've had these attacks in a hotel room where I have to catch a train the next morning or be kind of lost in a country where I don't speak a language, you know, and where I'm expected to speak that night and things like that. I've had to kind of gauge whether I can pack my clothes without, you know, vomiting, you know, like when I'm feeling really terrible, having to function. So it's not just about, it's about your state of consciousness when you're in the midst of wretchedness, where you're not able to just go to an unconditional state of mind, and discovering a place within oneself in which one's relationship to that wretchedness has a different kind of space, where you're resting in a place that's not conditional, where you're actually, in a weird way, you have a kind of sense of humor. You're aligned to something that's more important than how you feel, just and deeper and truer and more real than how you feel. And that's been a wonderful gift. And so I think that that has informed my teaching quite a lot.
So that so beautifully put, Terry, and I want to follow up on it in a specific way. So when you are in the midst of, as you called it, this wretchedness, your practice is to find that place which is truer and deeper than just how you feel. And yet at the same time, if I'm hearing you right, it requires a certain kind of presence, a certain kind of awareness, and a really profound acceptance that this is what you have to be with right now. Because there are so many kinds of energies and presences that you wouldn't be able to perform or to experience when you're in the midst of that, correct?
Yeah, true.
Yeah, yeah. And I so appreciate you for talking about, you know, the travel and the teaching, because I've had certain, you know, intense chronic muscle spasms that will sometimes happen right before the next workshop session is supposed to begin. And I'm wondering, am I going to have to curl up in a semi-fetal ball and tell people to wait for me for 45 minutes until it passes, or is it going to pass in with grace in such a way that I can keep to the schedule? And these are behind-the-scenes glimpses of people who are showing up to teach something about presence, about acceptance, about the spiritual path. And I think that our work and the whole conversation about this work would be incomplete if we didn't speak to these issues.
Well, I wasn't going to go there, but you called me out. That's your agenda, not mine, man.
Well, you could have said, I don't want to talk about it, so I know there was a problem that came with me. But I'll tell you, there's another part of it, too, that is worth just speaking to briefly. I have sometimes spoken about having my symptoms in a public talk, and then immediately afterwards had people come up to me and say things like, would you like to be free of those symptoms? And I kind of know what's coming, so I internally roll my eyes and I say, sure, I would. And then they hand me a business card about the latest supplement or the latest new technique for releasing oneself of this or that. And I'm actually very open to those things, and I've spent, you know, thousands of hours and hundreds of thousands of dollars in the explorations, both conventional and complementary. But what I notice is that we're engaged in a moment where I'm wondering if that person has a difficulty being with what I'm practicing being with, or if there is a belief that's present in that exchange that somehow there's something incomplete in me, or something that is even incomplete or erroneous in my teaching because, and this comes back to some of the things you were talking about earlier, like New Thought and The Secret, et cetera, because if, in fact, I were more realized, I wouldn't have this condition. So I'm wondering, from your perspective, how you hold not so much that idea, but how you hold yourself around how your symptoms do or don't relate to the depth of your offering.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, there's a number of things. There's actually something I'd like to say about the when you said, you know, people ask, would you like to be free of those symptoms? I have sometimes been confronted by people who feel absolutely certain. They have even a kind of glow about them. They're kind of lit up with the excitement of the thing they're connected with, that they feel certain. Really, they're not just having this as a feeling. They're standing in the existential reality, and their whole, you know, every cell of their body is kind of connected to the fact that they have these answers, and that they are standing as that set of answers, and they are there to bless, and they are just wanting to know, how bound are you by your limiting beliefs? And it's an interesting thing to confront that. I'm thinking of an occasion that took place a couple of years ago when I was in Germany, where I had that kind of a confrontation, and these people were offering to cure me permanently of my Meniere's disease, and I was having quite a few attacks during that trip, so I took them up on it, and I went into the next room and let them do their healing on me right then and there, and I didn't really have much of an, you know, it didn't heal me. It didn't work. But I had a chance to go deep into that, and it's very interesting how powerful conviction is, and when you arrive at a certain kind of certainty, the force of your confidence can reorganize people around you. Like, I found it possibly believable that the intense, radiant certainty that these people carried was founded in something that might be more powerful than the whole symptom pattern in my being. And in that moment, I kind of surrendered my own perceptual framing of things, which said that their kind of whatever it was, energetic healing, you know, it was unlikely to make a difference. I surrendered that and said, okay, well, I'll try in your reality for size. Let's go for it. Now, it's very interesting how we encounter these different kinds of beliefs, how certainty and doubt affect us. And when we're in a place of confidence and trust, something very, very healthy happens to us and to our whole beings. But when we rest that on beliefs that are brittle and narrow and that don't account for all of reality, of course, they're disproven in time and we crash. So a lot of us are so bruised that we can't find our way to a place of confidence and certainty at all. And it's like our whole capacity to rise to a place of confidence and certainty has become, you know, it's learned helplessness in that place. And yet I think that there is a basis for a different kind of confidence and a different kind of certainty that is not a true believer's rigid conviction. That is a possibility in a mature human being. And I wanted to just point to that. It's kind of a nuanced point, but it feels worth making since this is coming up. And then to go to your actual question.
don't go to my question yet. Stay with this because this is crucial. I love it. I'm on the edge of my seat wanting to know, just a taste, because I know you can't give it all to me here, but how you perceive being able to come to that confidence and conviction in a way that isn't standing upon brittle beliefs that would get disproven over time. That sounds to me like a growing edge for myself. So what can you tell me about that?
Well, I think that it requires growing in our embodied intelligence, you know, in our ability to take perspectives that are really complex and nuanced, and in which there's room for paradox and ambiguity and complexity and process, and in which we're thinking dialectically in the most rich and nuanced fashion, and not just thinking in the mind, but in which our feeling relationship to things is tracking that more nuanced disposition. And in that, we can come to a re-encounter with the most profound spiritual truths, and even some of the relative truths that come from traditions of spiritual practice, as well as a lot of practical on-the-ground know-how and savvy and clarities about life, such that we are, like, for example, the most ultimate expression of this has to do with, what would I be like if I were completely free? What would I be like if I were completely awakened or realized? What's the possibility of a, how does it feel to be most fully awake? And I think most of us have a picture of somebody like the Dalai Lama, who's kind of bubbly and spontaneous and laughing all the time, and it just seems like nothing bothers him at all. And we think we're supposed to be like that. And I think that that is a beautiful image, and I have utter respect for His Holiness, and I know He probably has a lot He could still teach me. But I think that the model of the wound of love, in which we are an unarmored, undefended, full, broken-hearted contact with all the suffering of the world, and we're letting that penetrate us, and we're in some sense weeping with, you know, tears streaming down our faces in sympathetic resonance with all of the pain and confusion and injustice and cruelty and anguish that is this embodied condition for humans and all the creatures, the poor factory farmed animals. Everything is like we're unarmored. We feel it all. And at the same time, we're in touch with the miracle of existence, the mystery itself, the radiant, transcendental okayness, the perfection of every moment, the gift of life, the miracle of existence. If we can be, in a sense, utterly joyful and utterly kind of crucified at the same time, I think that's a better model for what awakening really is. And I don't doubt that His Holiness, by the way, you know, probably is an example of that, whose outer aspect is very bubbly and joyful. But it can be, its outer aspect doesn't have to be bubbly. Its outer aspect could look like somebody just feeling very intensely into that pain. It doesn't have to, you know, there's no one way we have to look or be. And if we have that orientation emotionally, then if we're aspiring to grow and to develop and to do a practice in which we're growing in a fullness whose ultimate expression is more like that, then the more nuanced way that we're making room for the complex realities around us allows us to come into certain kinds of conditional clarities that can give us a basis for confidence and trust. And then we can relax a little because, you know, everything that can be lost will be lost. And do we have to be trembling in fear in the meantime forever? I don't think so. You know, the dawn is radiant. The sunrise is full of color. The birds are singing, you know, and there will be another morning. And even if the whole world were coming to an end, that last dawn would still be beautiful. Every moment, every fragment of this miracle is incredibly wonderful. And to be present to that, we can be confident in that. We can therefore trust. And out of that, we can have a kind of courage. We can become formidable, and we can become an embodied stand for that truth.
That's really beautiful, and I'm guessing right now that listeners have a clear understanding of why many times when you and I would get together for our dinners in Marin County that we would close down the restaurant and that I wouldn't want to leave, even if my eyes were closing with fatigue, because, Terry, you are always able to channel something that is so beautiful and rich and powerful, and I could feel that happening in these last few moments, and I'm still resonating with it. And I want to kind of complete the circle of this last realm of discovery by coming back to that moment where I might choose to try a new healing technique or put on someone's belief that it's possible that the way I'm holding my illness or my symptoms, if shifted, could lead me to a greater state of wellness. And if I take what you were just sharing into that healing session, it sounds to me like I would be saying that this is how it is. I can sink into what you called the crucifixion of that. I'm not pushing it away. I'm not needing it to be different in order to embrace the miracle. And at the same time, if there's something here for me that could bring healing, that could bring uplift, my intention is to be wide open to that and not let anything that is unnecessarily in the way within me prevent that from happening. So I have a deep acceptance and gratitude for what is, and an equal preference that something shift.
Well, and even I would go further, because, you know, I have a rich prayer life, in a sense. I mean, I don't have a conception of a metaphysical other who is the God to whom I pray, but I do recognize that no less real than this self is the great beloved. And so I actually enter into those moments with a kind of opening surrender that says, you know, let thy will be done. You know, help me be a vehicle for your grace. You know, please, it does hurt. This yelping pile of protoplasm wants not to hurt so much, and I gratefully invite and, in a sense, invoke and pray for grace and for healing and for completion. I think that I can do that with a kind of not knowingness that isn't, I mean, I was talking about certainty in a broader sense. This isn't the only frame for that kind of discussion of certainty, but you know, I do want to point out as we complete this that I'm answering the question you're asking right now, and I'm not making a summary comment about every form of certainty. That's all.
Sure. I think it's important to note that, and also I think it's really beautiful that you spoke to that particular moment that I was asking you about, because so many listeners will have their own version of that. It may be about a physical symptom. It may be about an emotional wound. But they will be hearing you guiding them exquisitely toward a confidence and conviction in which they can truly thrive and live as fully as possible as they're challenged very perhaps fundamentally, or in this case we've been speaking about physiologically, in some way that confuses them. And when I was saying that I heard you speaking to an edge for me, I think that's probably true for many, if not most people. I spoke in another conversation with a guest about, the way that acceptance and shame come together, where so often people are thinking that everything is a part of God except this one part of me, and that the healing path in those circumstances is along the lines of what you described earlier, people being able to make friends even with that part of themselves. And in this situation that we're talking about right now, it seems like there's an important parallel where we're often saying,
we could really embrace that kind of confidence and conviction and truly thrive if we didn't have X, whatever X is.
Right.
And even though we can't speak now to the whole of what you have to share about certainty, it seems like that you're addressing it in a very powerful way. You're inviting me and listeners to hold a kind of consciousness, sort of practice a kind of consciousness that would allow us to thrive as fully as we could, even if we continue to live with X, whatever that X is.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
I don't think that we're as fully open to healing. I don't think we're even fully open to healing, except to the degree that we let our heart break and we are willing to endure a really difficult and painful and even short life. And in some sense, we cease to only be braced in non-acceptance. And then with that basic acceptance, I think that we can turn to the healing potentials of our next moment with a kind of openness and a kind of anticipatory, willing gratitude that invites more healing into our lives much more effectively.
Well, I think this is the place that we need to leave it today, although I'm inspired and feel like somewhere down the road perhaps there's a part two or three or four, whether it's recorded or not recorded. So, Terry, I want to thank you so much for really being a trailblazer. I know that as you contemplated the theme of our series, you rolled up your sleeves and you looked at your moment and you said, how can I serve this series? And I'm very, very grateful to you for that. And also I'm excited because I know now that a lot of people will get a chance to see, you know, not only what those dinners are like, but why you're such a great friend.
Mm. Well, back at you, brother. It's always deeply nourishing to my soul to spend time with you.
You've been listening to Teaching What We Need to Learn, a unique online interview series in which leaders of personal growth and spirituality share their own innermost challenges. Two interviews are released each week during the series at teachingwhatweneedtolearn.com. That's also where you can send friends, family, and colleagues to sign up for the series, and I sincerely hope you will. We're also on Facebook as Teaching What We Need to Learn. The series producer is Julia Zaslow. Our chief technical officer is Kenneth Bushman. Our designer is Shannon Medisky. And our email management guru is Diana Pearson. Theme music is by Stephen Walters. You can find him at stephenwaltersmusic.com. A special thank you to our many volunteers and supporters, especially Bonnie McFarlane and Sandy Childs. I'm Raphael Kushner. You can learn more about my work and reach me personally at kushner.com. That's kushnir.com. That's where you can learn about both my weekend workshop and week-long intensive at the Kripalu Yoga Center in Massachusetts from June 22nd to the 29th. Thank you again for joining me, and here's to vulnerable, powerful, transparent wisdom.